France, Noise Orchestra, and he's going to tell us why space time behaves homogeneously in a big band.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Abhay. So this is the tentative title that Abhay had sent me on a subject that he would want me to talk about. And I was thinking, okay, he's inviting me to do a loop quantum cosmology conference. I don't know anything about loop quantum gravity. I'm not a cosmologist. And I figured they'd put me up at the Atherton, so I wouldn't even have the benefits of sleeping at a Holiday Inn the night before. So I thought, okay, I'll keep this title, and if I bomb this talk completely, I can blame it on Abhay. Okay, so what I would have probably suggested for a title, a slightly less ambitious title, is exploring the smoothing power of the ekpyrotic mechanism. So this will be a realization of a particular scenario, and we're going to model, not going to be getting any details of ekpyrotic cosmology, but essentially modeling Einstein's gravity with a scalar field with a very particular potential that's motivated by these ekpyrotic cyclic models, and showing in that particular case, in some sense that will hopefully be clear at the end of the by the end of the talk, that such potentials can generically drive a cosmology that starts in a very inhomogeneous anisotropic state towards a smooth FRW-like universe approaching the Big Bang crunch, so the Big Crunch. Okay, so the overview, I'll spend a little bit of time giving a bit of a background and motivation. So the motivation is that we are seeking, quote, natural solutions to some of the cosmological puzzles. And in particular, in this talk, I'm going to be focusing on the solutions to the flatness and horizon problems. And I'll sort of briefly mention a bit the two contemporary, in principle, answers to these problems are inflation and then these ekpyrotic cyclic models. So the rigorous content of this talk, the actual sort of results are going to be much more limited. So sort of working in the context of this one particular model and just investigating how robust this ekpyrotic mechanism is in preparing the universe in such a viable pre-Big Bang state. Given that this isn't a numerical relativity or a cosmology conference, but it is a quantum gravity course, perhaps I can just say that the message that I think might be useful in this context, so if you think about it, there really is no experimental data points for any quantum theory of gravity or quantum theory of everything. It's really by exploring relativity and field theories, we know there's at some level, the Planck scale, there's a fundamental inconsistency between these theories. And that has sort of driven theorists to look for, explore string theory or loop quantum gravity. But there is really no experimental data point driving people. And so what's been instrumental in progress in these theories are, in some sense, theoretical data points. For example, black hole entropy. No one has seen a black hole yet. No one has measured its temperature. No one has measured its entropy. But it's such a compelling theoretical argument that a black hole should have an entropy, and that it's spurred these theory or development of these theoretical ideas to look for ways in which a quantum theory could calculate black hole entropy. So it might turn out that with cosmology, for example, dark energy and dark matter are signs of some fundamental quantum theory of gravity, but we don't know that. But then there are these compelling ideas that, and I'll talk a little bit more about them, this problem of the horizon and flatness problem, and apparently that the current theories fail to explain that. And so this might be one of those grails that you can look for in trying to understand a fundamental theory that actually overcomes the problems of relativity and quantum theory at the Planck scale. And what I also want to emphasize is, I guess inflation's a rather well-known mechanism, but this, I'm sort of focusing on this ekpyrotic mechanism also to show that there are really two very complementary and alternative approaches that you could go to try to answer the question. For example, does a fundamental theory have some effective way of explaining the universe as we see it today? And there are really two very different ways in which, at least today, we think you could answer those questions. And I'll spend, most of the talk explaining the formalism, the initial data. And these are going to be numerical simulations, so I won't be able to prove anything in a mathematical sense. So I think it's going to be worth it to spend a little bit of time talking about the initial data to hopefully convince you that we've that it's reasonably generic within this the class of initial conditions that we've looked at, and then I'll just conclude. Okay, so just a very elementary introduction, just a reminder of the horizon and flatness problems. To establish theory, and by that I mean the standard model of particle physics and general relativity, and then we have to throw in these couple of perhaps slightly more embarrassing non-standard elements, dark matter and dark energy. But if you don't take those ingredients, you can construct a relatively consistent picture of the evolution of the universe from some time after the supposed Big Bang till today. You know, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the cosmic microwave background, simulations of large-scale structure formations, how the fluctuations of the background eventually grew to galaxies today. So it's all very well explained within this the standard theory. And I am sorry that this theoretical model has been essentially driven by an astonishing set of observations over the last couple of decades, you know, perhaps culminating in the WMAP observation. And at least in the next foreseeable decade or so, I think the experimental, the observational evidence or data points is just going to continue to grow. Hopefully they're going to measure non-Gaussianities and B-mode polarization, etc. So cosmology has become really a precision observational science, and it's really that that's sort of driven this picture of the universe. And the two perhaps remarkable things that have been observed about the universe is that, to within an astonishing degree, it is homogeneous and isotropic at the time of, well, today especially, and also at the time of recombination, so in the cosmic microwave background, that the image that we see was produced. And perhaps even more astonishingly, it's not only homogeneous isotropic, but if you look at the temperature, it's a thermal blackbody within one part in 10 to the 5. And incidentally, there's no way on Earth you can, in a lab, actually make a black body that's close to the theoretical prediction. So, I mean, if you're teaching first-year physics and students complain about spherical cows, and etc., well, you can point to the cosmic microwave background. There's one example where it fits theory to an astonishing degree. So why are those two observational points...
There was a black body, and the model was compared with that another experiment. It was compared
with that. In a sense, but so, I mean, if you actually just draw the spectrum, right, and you fit it with the black body spectrum, the deviations are a part in 10 to the 5.
Oh,
so, yeah, I see what you're saying, but I mean, or in a sense, I mean, we have theories, but I'm sure that we have theories that apparently explain everything. Well, that's what we tell students. But perhaps the two situations that I've just loved that where things are almost as perfect as a theory. One is black holes, and the other one is this microwave background. So, So why is smoothness and thermal equilibrium a problem? And that's perhaps generally classified as sort of the horizon and the flatness problems. So if we accept that in this regime where we made the observations, we understand nature, general relativity, the standard model, etc. If we extrapolate the observations backwards in time, that's where one of the problems arises. Well, one of course, is eventually you reach energy density which approaches the Planck scale, where we know these theories don't make sense. They're in conflict with each other. So that's one problem. If we want to have a self-consistent description of the universe from a theoretical point of view, we know that current theories aren't going to work at some point. But if you look at the cosmic microwave background, I'd say two points on the background that are separated by more than a degree. If you scale that back to the Planck scale, so back in time to this Planck scale, they were never in causal contact. So anything that's greater than a degree apart was never in causal contact. And as far as we understand thermodynamics, what produces a black body spectrum is something being in thermal equilibrium. So there was no physical process in the universe that occurred from the Planck scale onwards that would have produced the black body spectrum. And if you might say, well, there was some magic theory that had some initial conditions that gave the universe that initial shape. Why did it have to be a thermal spectrum? It's a very deep problem, and that's sometimes called the horizon problem. So the flatness problem, you can think of it, okay, well, let's say somehow magically whatever theory this superplane scale gives us some initial conditions for the universe, and you then evolve it forwards with our standard theories, which we think work beyond the Planck scale, you find that that the universe had to be flat to within one part in the 10 to the 60 to be as flat as it is observed today. And that's because deviations from flatness, as I'll show you in a couple of slides, would eventually dominate the universe. So that's sort of called the flatness problem. Never mind that comment. I think I sort of mentioned a little bit about that before. So given that there are these two sort of deep problems with, so people essentially want a natural dynamical solution to these problems. They don't want to say postulate it, you know, a priori. And so the two solutions that today are, I don't want to say that there aren't other solutions, but I think there are two solutions that have been well studied and are consistent with all present observations, and that's inflation, which Guth and others developed in the early 80s. And that postulates to solve these two problems by having, in the early universe, in the post Planck regime, a period of rapid expansion following the Big Bang. So that inflationary expansion, even if the universe isn't prepared in this very nice thermal isotropic state, that's going to essentially isotropize everything. Another solution that was proposed more recently are these so-called ekpyrotic or cyclic models. Again, I mean, the idea of a cyclic universe has been around for a long time, so that's not necessarily new. It's just this particular approach that actually not only solves the horizon and flatness problems, but is also consistent with the scale invariant power spectrum. That's really important because we're in this sort of age of precision cosmology. New models and new theories don't just have to explain why the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. They have to start explaining more details about it, such as there's one part in 10 to the 5 fluctuations you see on the cosmic microwave background. They have a near scale invariant spectrum, and as far as I know, these are the only two models that sort of consistently can produce that. So, interestingly, they're almost converses of each other, these two ideas. So inflation proposes to solve these problems by having this period of rapid expansion post Big Bang. The ekpyrotic model solves the problem by postulating that there was a period of slow contraction preceding the Big Bang. And just as a sort of a side comment, the original sort of motivation for these ekpyrotic models came from sort of string theory, these ideas of having multiple dimensions, these brain-like objects, and our universe is confined to one of these four-dimensional brains. And what the Big Bang was actually a collision between two brains. However, I'm not going to be, as people have sort of explored these models, it's turned out you don't really need that, you don't need to necessarily take that particular model seriously. You can just as with inflation is usually described as four-dimensional gravity plus some effective scalar fields, you can also describe these ekpyrotic models as four-dimensional gravity plus some scalar field with an effective potential. So we'll be taking that approach here. And translated into that language is a 4D effective theory with a scalar field or with some matter source which is driving either inflation or ekpyrosis. Inflation has a matter field with an effective equation of states, the pressure to the energy density of negative 1. And ekpyrosis, the matter has an effective equation of state that W much greater than 1. So again, the theme perhaps for this loop quantum cosmology conference is if you want to see whether you can derive one of these models from within a fundamental theory. And I didn't actually say it in words, but I had on a previous slide. I think that the big problem with all of these models is that they're only ideas about possible solutions to these problems. None of these models have been derived in any self-consistent way from a fundamental theory, which is perhaps not surprising because there really is no fully worked out fundamental theory yet. So in terms of seeing if something like this, if the particular theory that you're looking at, say loop quantum cosmology, could come up with a viable model of the universe, there's sort of two ways you can go about it. Does an effective theory come out of it where you have general relativity with a matter field that has an equation of state negative one, or one where you have an equation of state much greater than one? So from an effective field theory point of view, there's sort of two ways you can solve the cosmological problems. So I'm definitely not an expert on any of this, but as I understand it, there really is no fully self-consistent derivation of the entire cyclic picture. So you start, so I mean, there's some examples where they suggest that this idea can come from. There's also, for example, like string inflation, where they try to find various compactifications where when you do the compactification, you get a scalar field that looks like an inflaton. And there's suggestions of how to do that, but there's not been a fully self-consistent problem-free derivation. The same with these brain world cosmologies. There's some very specific examples which look like it might work, but I think because the string theory isn't fully developed, it's not. It's more like sort of proof in principle that at least in certain regimes of string theory space, whatever that is, that these ideas might be realized, but no one has done it as far as I know. Okay, so why do these two mechanisms solve the problem? And this is perhaps a nice way to see why both of these mechanisms work and why they are sort of inverses of one another. So this is the Friedman equation. So imagine, let's take a Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time with an ordinary pressureless matter field with some present energy density rho m sub zero. So at some initial scale of the scale factor A, that's the density in matter, in radiation rho sub r, in this exotic W fluid, that's how much energy density is present. And we're going to give it some curvature perturbation and some anisotropy or shear term. And this sort of explains how the various contributions to the energy of the universe essentially grows with time. So let's imagine, for instance, we don't have this W field. And now let's look at post-Big Bang. So in that case, the scale factor A of the universe is increasing with time. And so what eventually will dominate the behavior of the universe is the exponent, or the power of A here in the denominator that is the smallest exponent. And that turns out to be the curvature, A to the 2. And that's in some sense one way of looking at this flatness problem, that if there wasn't some fundamental reason why the curvature was exactly zero, you had matter and radiation in the universe at some point, eventually, even if there is some tiny infinitesimal perturbation, non-zero curvature, eventually it's going to take over and dominate the universe, and it shouldn't be flat at all. Yet we see the universe to be flat. So either it's a fine-tuning problem or there has to be some mechanism which gets rid of it. So the way that inflation proposes to get rid of this curvature problem is introducing this field here. And so with a general equation of state P over rho W, this is the way that it's going to scale with scale factor. So you can see if you make W negative 1, this power goes to 0. It becomes the largest, the dominant term in the governing the expansion of the universe, and it will eventually dominate over curvature. And essentially this will force the universe to a de Sitter-like expansion. So that's the sort of the inflationary solution. So now the Ekpyrosis solution is we flip everything around. We say we're not going away from the Big Bang. We're evolving towards the Big Bang. So now it's not the smallest power which is going to dominate the behavior of the universe towards the Big Crunch. It's going to be the largest power. And as Beverly spoke about, in that case, if you don't have any, you don't add any unreasonable matter, so you just have reasonable matter, the anisotropy in the universe that's going to dominate, and it's going to generically move it to some kind of chaotic mixed master type behavior. So, but since we can play this game of adding some matter source with an exotic equation of state, we can do exactly the same thing, but now we want to get this power to be larger than this largest power from the rest of the matter terms. And so if we get some matter which is an effective equation of state that's much greater than 1, this term is going to dominate. And again, it should drive the universe towards a homogeneous isotropic state approaching the Big Crunch singularity. So, and of course, I mean, one thing that I'm not going to be saying anything about, I'm just going to be looking at how well this ekpyrotic mechanism does smooth the universe. Of course, there's a big problem that, okay, what happens when you then approach this Big Crunch? How do you bounce through that towards the Big Bang then? And that's something that a theory of quantum gravity has to answer. But I'm just sort of just going to be focusing on this part of this cyclic or ekpyrotic scenario where you first smooth out all fluctuations as you approach the Big Crunch. Okay, so the previous Friedman equation was essentially you start with a universe which is close to homogeneous and isotropic, and you want to see how things behave when you perturb it a little bit. So for the mechanism to be believable, though, it has to be robust in the sense that even if you don't start with conditions that are close to Friedman, Robinson, Walker, that the mechanism still works. So, for example, in inflation, whatever initial quantum state produced the universe, it's very unlikely that it's going to produce it in a smooth state. But the claim is that then as soon as this inflationary mechanism takes over, it's going to smooth out the universe. And so the inflationary mechanism has to take over from something which is very far from homogeneous and isotropic to begin with. And there have been several results over the years, starting with some analytic proofs by Wald and also some numerical work, that have shown that the inflationary mechanism is robust in the sense that even if you start with some inhomogeneous and isotropic universe, if there's a matter with an equation of state W equals negative 1, the Sitter space is sort of an attractor solution in some sense. So eventually inflation will take over and drive the space-time to De Sitter. Previous work with the ekpyrotic mechanism has showed that at least at the linear level, the mechanism does work. So if you start with linear perturbations and some matter field with an ekpyrotic equation of state, it will suppress this chaotic mixed master behavior. So what I'm going to explain now is some work that I did with David Garfinkel, Wei Chet Lim, and Paul Steinhardt, where we show that we do give some numerical evidence that the ekpyrotic mechanism is also robust in the sense that if we start with very inhomogeneous initial data and a scalar field that has an effective equation of state negative 1, if in regions it starts, this ekpyrotic smoothing mechanism starts, it will eventually drive the universe to a smooth homogeneous state. Okay, so now onto the formalism. So we're going to be solving the Einstein equations with a scalar field with this particular potential. So it's a negative exponential with a negative slope. So those, this V naught and K are constants. And incidentally, figure those as being arbitrary constants that we can play around with. But this is sort of one of the, it is motivated by these brain world scenarios. So typically, you've got some higher dimensional space, you compactify to a four-dimensional effective theory. This scalar field, for example, might represent the distance between the two brains. So in general, in a realistic string-derived model, there are going to be multiple scalar fields. But if we just stay looking at this toy model where we're taking a single scalar field with one of these sort of brain world-inspired potentials. We're going to be using the orthonormal frame formalism, Hubble normalized variables introduced by Ugla et al., and very similar to what Adam had described before. And I'm sorry, some of my notation is going to be a little bit different, so I hope it's not too confusing, but at least I'm going to introduce all the variables that we use. So we're going to be choosing coordinates. We're going to be decomposing the Einstein equations in terms of this tetrad, well, four components. So there's going to be a time-like tetrad and then a spatial tetrad. And so we're going to be choosing a time-like vector field that has no vorticity, and we're going to sort of firmly propagate the spatial tetrads along this time-like tetrad. And so in terms of coordinate, in a coordinate basis, this is the definition of our tetrad. So that's going to be the Laplace function. And those are the components of the tetrad. So we're going to decompose the commutators of the tetrad into these sort of irreducible sort of tensor and vector components, scalar tensor vector components of the tetrad. So the commutator of the time-like tetrad with the spatial legs is an acceleration component there's an overall expansion of the time-like vector field, which is just, we're going to call H the Hubble scalar. There's a shear of this tetrad, sigma. And similarly, with the commutator of the spatial tetrad, we can decompose it into these two objects, A and N. And they don't have as clear-cut, as geometric meaning as the shear and expansion for the above two symbols, but they contain information essentially about the spatial geometry. And then, so these are just the definition of the tetrad and decomposing them into the components. Then, as before, we're going to non-dimensionalize them and make them scale invariant by dividing them by the Hubble scalar. So this, I think this is what's called omega. And so we divide them by, we take this particular real, divide by omega to form these scale invariant components that we will eventually be evolving. And so, incidentally, again, just one reason to think why we'd want to do this. The Hubble scalar is diverging as we approach the singularity. This is sort of the scale factor, the ratio of the time derivative divided by the scale factor of the universe, which is going to zero. So the Hubble scalar is diverging. Essentially, all of these quantities are diverging as we're approaching the singularity. And that's not a sensible way to try to solve things with computers. You want to do things where the numbers are of order unity or as close as you can to get that. And it turns out that most of these variables sort of diverge at roughly the same rate as the Hubble scalar. So dividing them out by this quantity, we get numbers that we can evolve that are of order unity throughout the simulation. We do the same thing with the matter variable. So remember, we have a single scalar field. We're going to be defining this capital W, essentially the scaled time derivative of the scalar field. This vector S is the rescaled gradient of the scalar field, and we're going to rescale the potential by, again, making it dimensionless by the second power of the Hubble scalar. So we're going to be evolving the variables here on the left-hand side for matter. Incidentally, as I mentioned, that the one thing that characterizes, you know, whether ekpyrosis or inflation happens is this effective equation of state W. And it's going to turn out that in these simulations, even though this isn't a fluid, in general, it doesn't really even make sense to think of this as a scalar field having an equation of state. But as we'll see, at late times in the evolution, even though W starts sort of nonsensical, it actually approaches two very distinct regimes at late times. And so it's a very useful quantity to show or to visualize what's happening. And in these particular scale invariants, it takes this form. So the ratio of the pressure in the scalar field to the energy density just takes that form. Okay, so the next step is, so we've almost fixed all of our coordinate freedom by choosing the tetrad to be essentially no shift, vorticity free, but we still have we now still have to choose how we're going to foliate our space-time, and we choose constant mean curvature slices, which is effectively choosing the Hubble scalar to have this form. And again, you know, we're using perhaps somewhat confusing variables, and that we're going to start at t equals zero. We're going to be evolving towards the singularity, which is going to be happening at minus infinity, so we're going backwards in time. So with this particular foliation, the Hubble scalar blows up exponentially as we approach the singularity. So grinding all these definitions through the Einstein equations, we get a set of evolution equations for every component of these scale invariant variables. I'm not going to bother writing them down. It's not too illuminating. And the same thing with the Klein-Gordon equation for the matter variables. And so that's what we're going to be solving numerically. Sorry? Yes, they're all coupled. There's non. Minimal coupling, right? Does it matter? I would think not, but I haven't tried it any other way. Okay, so those are the evolution subset of the Einstein equations. We all know what the Einstein equations also have. Intrinsic constraint equations. So in other words, sets of equations that depend on these variables, but not their time derivative. So in a sense, if we think of this as just a system of equations to evolve. We're free to specify initial conditions for all these quantities, and this tells us how to evolve them with time. But of course, the Einstein equations, and here, because we've reduced them to first-order equations, plus the identities from the commutator relationships, introduce additional constraints amongst these variables. So we cannot freely choose initial data for all of those variables. So that is a common problem that you always have to deal with when you solve the Einstein equations. The one nice thing about the equations is we only have to solve the constraints at the initial time. And at least at the analytic level, then, you're guaranteed that if you have self-consistent initial data, the evolution equation will preserve the constraints with time. Numerically, that's often a bit trickier, but at least in these simulations with this set of equations, the constraints are preserved to within the truncation error as we evolve. So we only have to solve the constraints at the initial time. And the way we're going to be doing it is the so-called York procedure. Because one thing, just looking at those equations, it's not obvious or easy to identify which variables you consider to be freely specifiable and which are constrained. In some sense, it's almost arbitrary how you decide to separate them. And this York procedure is just a very nice way of, at least one particular way of separating variables into those that you can freely specify and then those which you have to solve via equations. And you essentially do it by conformally rescaling all the variables in your problem. So I'll just sort of outline exactly what we do. So specifically what we do is we can freely specify a conformally rescaled metric. So if this HIJ is the physical spatial metric, we define this conformally rescaled metric as follows. So psi is a conformal factor that depends on space. We can specify this conformally scale. So we can specify the scalar field at the initial time and its conformally rescaled velocity q. In terms of the shear tensor, or the scale invariant shear tensor EIJ, we can specify the divergence-free part of that tensor. So this tensor, incidentally, it's trace-free and symmetric. And so we can divide it up into a part without a divergence, so a divergence-free part, and it's this part that we can freely specify. And then one of the constraint equations tell us what the divergence has to be. So essentially, the divergence has to be proportional to the momentum that the matter fields have. So again, we specify a conformal metric, a conformally rescaled velocity, the actual value of the scalar field, the divergence-free part of the shear tensor as free variables, and then the constraints will tell us, we'll solve the constraints to find out what the conformal factor is and the other variables. Okay, so to recap a bit, at this stage, this formalism is very general. I mean, we can simulate a very wide class of cosmologies with this. In particular, the only assumptions we've made are essentially gauge choices, and perhaps the biggest assumption might be to adapt the equations to the problem at hand is that we've assumed that these constant mean curvature foliations exist. However, those equations by themselves are complicated. If you want to do full 3D simulations, it should just be beyond computational resources at this time. So just to make things tractable, we're now going to restrict spacetimes where the deviations in homogeneity are only in one spatial direction. So it's all of our fields now we're going to say only depend on one spacetime direction. So essentially there's two space-like killing fields. And you can think of the two, say, the y, z directions, if you imagine identifying them, and then we are going to identify the x direction. So this will be a T3 type topology. And this may seem like a serious restriction, especially if you want to make claims about how robust this generic ekpyrotic mechanism is. And you're right, to some extent, that's going to eventually have to be checked. We're going to have to reduce that restriction. However, I think there are a couple of arguments that we can sort of make that suggest there's perhaps not such a bad, that the extra two dimensions aren't going to be affecting the conclusions much. And one is that even in this one-dimensional case, it's essentially what we'll see is that this BKL conjecture holds even here, is that spatial derivatives become negligible at late time. So even even in this one direction, so let me just go back here. So for example, in this effective equation of state, right, it's the kinetic, the time derivative piece, the potential, and this should be the sum of three spatial derivatives. So now we're restricting it to one non-trivial dimension, so there's only one term here. But even in this case, that term turns out to be completely relevant. Even this one spatial derivative term doesn't matter in the approach to the singularity. It seems strange if you then added a couple of extra, why suddenly derivatives would matter. And the other bit of sort of some evidence that might make us feel that this is not too such a bad restriction is this is very similar to the example that Garfinkel studied in the generic the vacuum case. And in that case, when comparing it to similar solutions with just one dimension, he didn't find any qualitative different behavior. So in the vacuum case, it doesn't seem like extra dimensions really is going to qualitatively change the behavior. So we can hope that this is not such a serious problem. Okay, so just to go over again the solution, this is the exact initial data that we're going to be giving. We're going to choose the conformal metric to be flat. There's because we periodically identified the x direction, there's one natural scale, and we're going to say that the initial divergence free part of the shear tensor is periodic with that scale. And then we're going to choose a time derivative and a spatial, so the spatial profile for the scalar field and the time derivative with some arbitrary additional length scales, and then various amplitude parameters. And then, of course, the two constants in our potential are also variables that we can specify. And again, this is not, in some sense, the most general class of initial conditions, even now restricting to 1D, but we believe it's sufficiently general that we can actually capture the generic behavior in this case. So we specify those, so we choose that as our initial freely specifiable variables. We reconstruct the conformally rescaled shear tensor Z. And once we have that, then we solve the Hamiltonian constraint for the conformal factor. And I decided just to show this equation just to emphasize, even though that our initial metric is conformally flat, you might argue, okay, well, we want to start with cosmologies which are not close to flat. But just so that conformally flat, the actual initial physical metric is going to be very far from flat. And incidentally, if it were flat, then, you know, psi equals 1 would be a solution. But in general, it's not going to be a solution. And all these freely specifiable quantities, the scalar field, the shear, the time derivative, the potential, are going to contribute to non-trivial initial curvature in the space. So I think conformal flatness isn't, you know, I guess I can't prove this sort of mathematically, but we're not really restricting the classes of spacetimes by this assumption. So, okay, once we've solved the Hamiltonian constraint, we can reconstruct all of the geometric variables, and then we can solve the CMC condition to find the initial conformal laps. Okay, I'm not going to talk about the numerical method, just give a one-slide overview. If there are more questions about it, people can ask me afterwards. But so we're going to solve these difference equations using second-order accurate finite difference techniques with Berggren-Olliger-style adaptive mesh refinement implemented with these packages which can be downloaded from that website. We use a Crank-Nicholson-type scheme for the hyperbolic equations and a full approximation storage multigrid algorithm for the elliptic equations. So initially we have two elliptic equations, the CMC condition, the Hamiltonian constraint, and then during evolution, the evolution equations are all hyperbolic, but the CMC slicing condition is elliptic. And just one interesting side comment is that this BKL conjecture of locality even sort of influences, or is in some sense also demonstrated by the numerics. So usually with a scheme like this, there's a so-called CFL factor. You can't take time steps that are too large relative to your spatial step. And so with this Berggren-Olliger type mesh refinement, the reason why we need this, and I'll show you some examples of that, is that in regions where the universe doesn't become flat, we do get these spikes that form, and they're exponentially narrowing, and so we need a lot of resolution to resolve them. And so when you add resolution, you're adding smaller mesh spacings. And so the CFL stability condition says that you correspondingly have to decrease your time step. But we find that we don't have to do that. We can take CFL factors, or we've run simulations where the CFL factor reaches something like 10 to the power 6. And greater than 1 is sort of the numerical back of the thumb, or sort of rule of thumb law for instability. And we find that there isn't an instability. And what's it really telling us is that these equations are essentially becoming ODEs. The spatial terms aren't mattering as we approach the singularity. Yeah, so... there is a scale that's developing around the spikes, but the actual, I think it's something like, because you multiply it by the E terms, and that is going to zero faster than what the length scale of the spike is shrinking as. So in some sense, it's relative to the rest of the universe, it is a sharp feature, but it's still local at the spike. Yeah. Okay, so now...
But this you found by first doing it more carefully, and then you don't have to do it more
carefully. The thing was, so even 1D, when the spike forms, it starts refining, you know, it goes 2 levels, 3 levels, 4 levels, it eventually goes to like 20 levels of refinement. And then if you're sub-cycling, so you're refining in time, like for each single step you're taking millions of time steps on the fine level. And so we just couldn't get anywhere, even with mesh refinement. And then we said, well, let's see what happens. If it really is local, we turn it off. And then we could actually evolve this thing for a reasonable amount of time. So if we had to do subcycling, we wouldn't be able to get very far in the non-smooth regions. Okay, so... So I'm going to show some animations, and I'm going to show several quantities, like the effect of equation of state. But one other useful thing to show you what's happening is to show sort of the three main contributions to the energy density of the universe. So we can essentially break apart it into matter contributions. So in these Hubble normalized variables, this is sort of the Hamiltonian constraint. The energy density in matter is just the sum of the derivative terms plus the potential. And then we're separating the rest of the geometric contributions to the energy into the shear component. And then we just call the rest the curvature. So this set of terms here. So the sum of these things always have to be 1. But this will be useful to show you, for example, if you're going to a matter-dominated region, omega m will approach 1, the rest will go to 0, etc. So that's a useful diagnostic to show what's happening. So just to describe the results before I show you the animation. So even though we've restricted to 1D, we've still got a huge parameter space. So we've only been able to do a very small sampling in some sense. But we think we've done enough so that this is not we didn't have to look very hard to find this generic, this kind of behavior. So we think this is fairly generic. And so the results are that if you have a potential that's sufficiently steep, so that parameter k, so it's minus v naught e to the minus k times phi, if that k is sufficiently large, then the universe will become, that will sort of begin this ekpyrotic, or this ekpyrosis mechanism, and the universe will become homogeneous, isotropic, and matter-dominated. And that effective equation of state parameter of a fluid, of the scalar field, will look like a fluid with a W much greater than 1. At least certain regions of the universe, this mechanism will take over and drive it to a homogeneous and isotropic state. In the rest of the universe, and in situations where the potential isn't steep enough, the entire universe, the universe doesn't smooth out. You essentially get at least a period of this mixed master-like dynamics, but as Beverly described, because of the scalar field, there's always going to be a last bounce. There's some mixed master dynamics, there's a last bounce, but the universe never homogenizes or isotropizes. And incidentally, spikes also form in those regions where the universe doesn't isotropize. However, if you look at the volume, the ratio of the volume of the region that's becoming smooth to that that's non-smooth, it exponentially grows with time, at least as measured by these constant mean curvature slices. And so that's why we're going to say this ekpyrotic smoothing mechanism is robust. So as long as there's one place in the universe where this mechanism takes over, at late times it's going to grow to dominate the entire universe. So you can almost think of it as there'll still be certain little pockets of anisotropy and nastiness happening in the curvature, but those are going to shrink to zero exponentially fast as you approach the singularity. Or just if anyone wants for this, I'm going to show a couple of examples. In this one example, these are the various parameters. Don't worry about them. But the one thing that perhaps think of is this that constant k in the potential we chose to be 10 in this example. So here's this first animation. I'm sorry, a little bit of comment. It's cut off down there. So one thing for visualization purposes, the visualization program doesn't like it if t goes backwards. So t here is actually going to count positive, but t is actually minus t. So t is going negative towards the singularity. So with this class of initial conditions, this is the three contributions to omega. So at any one point, the sum of these has to be one. So you can see that, you know, curvature contributions and matter contributions don't have to be positive. So this is the shear component in blue. The pink is the curvature, and this yellow is the matter. So this is a very inhomogeneous anisotropic universe to begin with. So let me play. And so you can see very quickly a region of the universe develops where it becomes completely matter dominated. The curvature components go to zero, but there's this region here I wonder if I've mislabeled it. There's something I might be getting the shear and the curvature mixed around. But in any case, there's a region where neither matter nor curvature dominates. It's not homogeneous, and there's some contribution from curvature and matter. Actually, to show you that sort of some mixed master-like behavior is taking place. So this simulation we actually ran to about t equals 150, but this region is very boring. So I'm just going to zoom in the next slide to show you a little bit what happens in that region. And so you can see that now as we're continuing in time, you know, we get these various transitions, which are essentially these balances between Kasner-like solutions. And so this region never smooths out, but there will always be a last bounce. And this is sort of where we stop the simulation. And one thing I just want to mention, and I'll show you a simulation later which zooms in on one of those spike structures. But here, for visualization, I converted this to a uniform mesh. And the spikes narrow so rapidly at some point they fall between a mesh spacing. So it looks like, I'll play the animation again, it looks like you get certain spike features and eventually they smooth out, but they don't. They're still being resolved by the simulation. It's just here. So for example, right, there's a spike that's formed. That looks like it's smoothed out, but it hasn't. It's just fallen between the mesh spacing on this, just for visualization purposes. So this part of the universe is not smooth. It's not, the ekpyrotic mechanism hasn't taken over.
But then there's up in the last bounce?
Sorry?
But then it would be a last bounce.
Yeah, so in this case, there are going to be these sort of bounces between Kasner epochs, but at some point, like the that diagram that Beverly showed, when you add matter, there's some point where they're going to bounce to some...
So essentially, at some point, it's going to just freeze
in. Yeah, we haven't evolved it far enough where that's happened, but we generically expect that it's going to freeze in.
So that inhomogeneity
and that's
also just a thing.
Yeah.
In this case, it's not anisotropic because you know what you want to do.
Well, so in some scenarios, like, so one, each of these is going to have, there's going to be different expansion rates in different directions. So each point is going to be a different anisotropic universe. Okay, so now going to a different visualization package, which has its similar quirk. So again, time is going negative. Here I'm showing this effective equation of state parameters. So you can see initially there are places where it goes to minus infinity, plus infinity. It's all over the place. It doesn't really even make sense to perhaps say that there's an effective equation of state because this isn't a fluid. It's a scalar field. But if you remember, this is the same initial data, so roughly the same regions. Remember, this is where the universe homogenized. This is where it wasn't. So you'll see. So very quickly, in this region which homogenizes, it goes to here 32 and a third, and to its numerical error, it is exactly 32 and a third. So an equation of state W much, much greater than 1. So you can see that so the back of the envelope expectation from the Friedman equation, if W was much greater than 1, it would take over and homogenize the universe. That is happening. And it's interestingly, in the place where the ekparadic mechanism doesn't take place, it goes to an omega equals 1. So W equals 1 effective equation of state. And we'll get back to where these numbers come from later. Oh, just so I'm glad you showed those examples. I was hoping you would show like the Kasner circle and stuff, so I wouldn't have to explain it. Or because this visualization package is again, it's the research quality. It's what we use to look at our simulation results. So it doesn't add axes or fancy things. But so here, what I'm going to impart here is just a slightly different visualization of the simulation to show you how. So what's going to be plotted here is I'm taking one point of the simulation and plotting this sort of the state space representation of a trajectory of one point in the simulation. So this variable sigma minus versus sigma cross. So this is sort of the Kasner circle. And so one point, so for example, this initial frame is going to be the x equals 0 point of the simulation. That's a point that homogenizes. So this is t equals 0. This is going to t equals minus infinity. It flows to the center of this Kasner circle. So this point is a special point which represents a homogeneous isotropic universe. So this animation is going to be scanning in x. So each, let me just press my back up. Right, so each point here, it's going to be showing the trajectory of that point on this state space diagram. So the smoothing is going to be represented by trajectories that all flow towards the center point. The initial inhomogeneity is going to be that there's going to be an initial region here. So the range of different points where this universe starts from. So not all points start at this one point. There's going to be a region in state space where they start. A whole bunch of them are going to flow to this point. Several of them are going to execute that Kasner-like dynamics. So you can see, so initially scanning along X, all those points are, they start in an inhomogeneous state, but they all flow towards this homogeneous state. Now we're getting to the point where regions where they don't isotropize, and you can start seeing that mixed master-like type dynamics. But a lot of them have sort of ended at a point here, sort of away from the Kasner circle, and that's sort of the last bounds. In any case, in a slightly different way of visualizing the simulation. Okay, so I mentioned that we're saying that this mechanism is robust because when the ekparadic behavior takes over, it dominates the volume of the universe. And from those animations, it definitely did look like that, right? I mean, there was a finite volume that stayed inhomogeneous. However, we were plotting functions there as a function of coordinate volume. What you really want to look at is the proper volume element of space-time. And it turns out if you do that, even though in these constant mean curvature slices, that inhomogeneous region has the same coordinate volume, the proper volume is shrinking to zero. And perhaps the easiest way to demonstrate that, rather than trying to reslice our space-time, is to note that if HIJ is our physical spatial metric, the local volume element is just the root of the determinant of that. And it turns out that in these variables with CMC slicing, this conditions hold. So the fractional derivative of the volume element is 3 times the scale invariant lapse. And remember, we're now t is going to minus infinity, so that's the approach to the singularity. So in regions where the scale invariant lapse tends to a constant, we can just solve this equation. It shows that the volume element grows or decreases exponentially in this fashion. So the larger that the lapse is, the faster the local volume element is going to go to zero. Let me just show you the animation of the scale invariant lapse, right? So this is the initial value. So it starts, this is a function of initial conditions. And now we're going to evolve this with time. And so you can see in the region which becomes homogeneous, it tends to a very small number. Whereas in the region which is inhomogeneous, for the most part, it's a third, except the places where those spike transitions are happening. So this is showing that the volume element in this inhomogeneous part of the universe is collapsing much, much rapidly, much more rapidly to zero than in the corresponding homogeneous region. And a few slides will sort of quantify exactly by how much. I just want to show you another example just to demonstrate that we actually are resolving the spike. So this is not really anything qualitatively different, but it's just, I think, just fun to see one of these spike structures. This is an interesting example. So it's very similar initial data. Actually, we started without any scalar field, except there was only a non-trivial potential and a slightly smaller value of this parameter k. And actually, with this initial data, it turns out that the whole universe eventually becomes homogeneous and isotropic. And there is a spike that forms, but even that is eventually smoothed out. So this is a much smaller value of this k. So this ekpyrotic mechanism is going to eventually take over, but it just takes a much longer time. And it doesn't happen quickly enough to prevent the spike from forming in the first place. So to what I've done here, just one thing. So I've added this little 10 to the minus 5 here. So I've shifted the initial conditions for the shear by 10 to the minus 5, because without that, the spike would form at x equals 0. So I shifted it by 10 to the minus 5 just for visualization purposes, so you could see it and not just see half the spike. So that was just a thing, so I could use this package to show it. So let me just show you the three values of omega. And so you see initially it's inhomogeneous, the matter isn't dominating, but in the central region the matter starts to dominate. Here at x equals 10 to the minus 5, a spike forms. This, again, it's falling through the cracks, but eventually this matter-dominated region grows to encompass the entire universe, and it actually does then really smooth out the spike. And to show you that on this right animation, I'm going to then zoom into a volume that goes from 0 to 2 times 10 to the minus 5. So initially, it's not going to look very interesting. So the universe starts to evolve. Now, at this moment, we're really zooming close on the spike. So the spike is larger than the volume of the animation, but the spike is shrinking exponentially fast. And so eventually the spike is going to now enter our volume, so that's a spike. But now the ekpyrotic mechanism takes over, it smooths out the spike, and we're going to evolve to a completely homogeneous universe. So just sort of an example of a spike, and that we actually are following, we are resolving the entire universe with these simulations. So I think here what's very useful, at least what's also useful to us in sort of understanding it, is to get an analytic description of what's going on. Because, I mean, you can show this, just a couple more slides. So, I think from the animations, you can sort of see what's happening, and we can show that at least sort of qualitatively, you could see that the lapse function was a couple of orders of magnitude larger in the anisotropic region. So the volume element had to go to zero that much faster. But again, if we assume that in the approach to the singularity in both regions, whether it's homogeneous or not, that the spatial terms are becoming irrelevant, we can actually compute all of those things exactly. And then we can compare it to the numerical results to see if that assumption, if those assumptions were valid. And it turns out that they are. Except that at spike, at those isolated spike points. But so away from the spike points, they're dropping all spatial derivative terms, all variables that are defined to be spatial derivatives, such as S from the equations. We can actually solve for the limiting behavior of the various quantities, and this is the result. So in the region which becomes smooth, so we assume that in the smooth region, this Hubble normalized potential always is finite, but non-zero. And so this is the limiting behavior. We found that the scalar field goes to minus infinity. The time derivative of the field goes to that constant k. The potential goes to 3 minus k squared over 2. That was remembered before when I said, remember the scale, so I won't play these again, but remember the... I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me just finish this discussion. The lapse goes to 2 over k squared, and the effective equation of state goes to k squared over 3 minus 1. So remember I said it was 32 and a third, and that numerically it turned out to be exactly the same as the asymptotic relationship. So k was 100, so 33 and a third minus 1, 32 and a third. In the non-smooth region, the potential vanishes, so the ekpyrotic mechanism doesn't take hold, but we have this limiting behavior. So we see the lapse goes to a third. And remember that animation that I showed before where the scale went from, you know, 2/100 to a third. So we exactly recover that limiting behavior. The scalar field goes to a state where it's effectively described by a fluid with an equation of state W equals 1. And in some sense, the profile just freezes in as the scalar field goes to plus infinity. So I showed these two animations before. Let me just show you what those other fields look like. So, okay, so this is a scalar field. So you can see in the inhomogeneous region, it develops some profile, but it's continuing to grow. In the place where it's smooth, it's tending towards minus infinity. It's very slow in these Hubble normalized variables, but essentially that's the profile. This is the velocity term. So sorry, the scale here is very, this is minus 2.4 and this is 10. So it actually does tend to 10, and this was a case where k was 10. Whereas in the inhomogeneous region, it's got some profile. You can see there's still some of those transitions happening, so it hasn't quite settled into this particular profile, but it freezes in with some profile. And then this Hubble normalized potential, the scale, this is minus 47 and this is 0. So you can see in the non-smooth region, the potential becomes completely irrelevant. It drops to 0, and the normalized parameter goes to 3 minus k squared over 2. So just to give you some numbers for when this ekpyrotic mechanism is expected to actually take over. So now with these analytic estimates for what the potential is, what the lapse is, recall that it was this was the expression for the local volume element. So if we integrate it over the region, over the coordinate volume of the universe, which is in either of these respective regions, the ratio of matter dominated to smooth region is given by this form. If we assume that this late time asymptotic behavior is correct, and if the actual coordinate volume is not changing with time at late times, at least from the simulations, that seems to be the case. So this says that the ratio of matter dominated to an isotropic region essentially will go to infinity as long as k squared is greater than 6, or k is greater than root 6. So that sort of quantifies how steep this potential has to be for the ekpyrotic mechanism to actually take over. So the conclusions and future work. So we demonstrated that the ekpyrotic mechanism is in some sense as robust as the inflationary mechanism, in the sense that if it does take over in some part of the universe, it will dominate. Essentially, the regions where it doesn't take hold will shrink to zero exponentially fast relative to those that do. In terms of future work, you know, this, even at the toy model, this isn't incomplete, and especially in terms of, well, does this, so we've shown that there's a smoothing phase approaching the Big Bang, but of course in this model, this is just GR with a scalar field. That's going to run smack into the Big Bang. There's not going to be any bounce. There's not going to be any Big Bang. There's not going to be any cosmic microwave background produced. So this is definitely not, even within this ekpyrotic or cyclic models, complete in any sense. So the next thing to do would be to extend the model by perhaps having a second scalar field component, perhaps attaching it to, or feeding it as input to some, say, for example, loop quantum gravity or loop quantum cosmology calculation that says that it can evolve through a smooth bounce, and to see exactly what happens to the universe as you go through a bounce. For example, there could still be a couple of problems with this mechanism. For example, this is very, very efficient at smoothing the universe. But to get a bounce, eventually this matter field, this equation of state W greater than 1 must somehow turn off, and some other effective matter field that violates the negative energy condition, sorry, the null energy condition has to take over. And that has to happen quite a ways before the Planck scale. So as soon as this ekpyrotic field turns off, inhomogeneities are going to start growing again. So it's only this field that's suppressing that. And so then the question is, well, before the bounce happens, or does the bounce happen sufficiently soon after the smoothing phase that it doesn't destroy all the smoothing that has happened in this phase? Well, that's just one of the questions, but so the next step would be to actually try to extend this through a bounce and see if we can actually get a reasonable initial spectrum post bounce. So I won't say any more. Thanks. So I don't think anyone has done that yet, but I think it's definitely something that's doable. So in some sense, it's arbitrary. I mean, we start at t equals zero, which defines some intrinsic scale. We can always change the initial scale to some arbitrary value. So I mean, these are scale invariant quantities. So in some sense, you can pick some time to say that, let's say this is the Planck time, and then work backwards and say what was the scale today. But that's in some sense arbitrary, and you can always. So perhaps I didn't quite get. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, with this value of the potential, what is the energy density if we restored units? So I'm not an expert on the sec product stuff at all, but I know there was that criticism by Linde et al., and then I know Steinhardt et al. Then sort of countered it or came up with perhaps some alternative potentials. But I think this is the.
But it's very interesting that if you assume the trusted equation of state, everything is very good. So if you have some parameters, such that you reach W and that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That I completely agree. Now my comment is that as you mentioned later on, that we need some phase where we should be validating energy conditions. Mm-hmm. That's not acceptable because even if you look at Einstein equations, this viewpoint only deals with modifying team
Right.
Without violating energy conditions, you make it a bond.
Yeah.
So this we have looked at, and you see, using the same prevention. Mm-hmm. Like when the school and myself have done a couple of papers on that, and we show that one can get bonds with the same values of parameters which is 900 here.
Okay.
So this has been done.
Okay, well, that's good. So, yeah.
I think the time is just a moment. Again, as I said, we have, I don't know, 1.5 or 2 hours of discussion session with the afternoon.
Okay.
Can definitely come back. I also have a bunch of questions.
Okay.
You're here for the afternoon.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
Thank you.
So we return here again at 1:45.